welcome to a special edition of Mormon Expression. This is Zilpha. I have strung together all of the entries for the essay contest, and I provide a brief introduction to each one. I think it will become very clear to everyone that there were a lot of excellent essay entries. And John and I chose our favorite, which you will find at the very end of the essay show. Additionally, this year, we've decided to award a second $100 to a People's Choice winner. So People's Choice means you guys need to vote. And the way you will do that is you will send the name of the essay or the name of the person who wrote it to mail@mormonexpression.com, and you need to do this by the last day of September. This first essay by Jesse, called Blinking in the Starlight, looks at the movie Tangled as a comparison to the way the church manipulates its members and withholds important information from them. Jesse expresses the wonderment he is now experiencing as he begins to explore the world beyond the church, which he compares to breaking out of the tower, and he rejoices in his newfound freedom.
As I've passed through the various phases of disaffection and started to see the scope of the problem facing so many people, I can't help but ask why. Why did polygamy happen? Why did Joseph Smith say the Kinderhook plates were ancient? And why did the church leaders insist he was correct until the 1980s? Why did I not know about something as basic as the Book of Abraham controversy until years after serving a mission and being married in the temple? Why am I in this mess? And then I saw the movie Tangled.
Flower, gleam, and glow. Let your power shine. Make the clock reverse. Bring back what once was mine. Heal what has been hurt. Change the fate's design. Save what has been lost. Bring back what once was mine. What once was mine.
I'm not in the habit of identifying myself with Disney princesses, but the story makes for an interesting comparison. Tangled is an entertaining kids' film which, at its heart, focuses on the idea of exploitation. It's the story of a beautiful girl, Rapunzel, who has the gift to heal and make others young by singing a song and brushing her hair. She's kept locked up, high in a tower, by Mother Gothel, a passive-aggressive imposter claiming to be her mother.
Rapunzel?
Yes?
Don't ever ask to leave this tower again.
Yes, Mother.
The comparison of Mother Gothel is an enlightening one. Mothers should protect and nurture us, sacrificing and helping us grow so we can eventually become strong enough to operate independently. And this is basically how I viewed the church. But Mother Gothel, she was different. Because her goal was exploitation rather than real love, she would fulfill only the basic needs of her captive, keeping Rapunzel placated so she could hoard the benefits of her magical hair. I can't help but feel some similarity to Rapunzel. The church has given me many great things. Friends, community, role models. It's helped me on several levels. But ultimately, when I really look around, I was shuttered up inside a cage. The flaw with Mother Gothel's strategy was that Rapunzel would eventually grow up and innately desire to leave the tower. It was just in her nature. To prevent this, Mother Gothel invented lies about how awful the outside world was.
You want to go outside? Why, Rapunzel? Mother knows best. Listen to your mother. It's a scary world out there. Mother knows best. One way or another, something will go wrong, I swear. Ruffians, thugs, poison ivy, quicksand, cannibals and snakes. The plague.
No.
Yes.
Also large bugs, men with pointy teeth, and
stop no more. You'll just upset me. Mother's right here.
Mother will protect you. Darling, here's what I suggest. Skip the drama, stay with
Mother. The world. In Mormonism, that phrase is shorthand for all the horrible things outside the tower. Ruffians and drunkards, lies and unhappiness, drugs, pornography, belly rings and bestiality. The world outside my tower was so unattractive and awful, I hardly ever considered what could be out there. And in truth, the tower actually looked pretty good before I knew about an alternative or had any kind of reason to leave. Sure, it was repetitive, boring, and somewhat confusing, but nonetheless pleasant. That's how I felt just a few years ago. I had reread all the same books, like Jesus the Christ and the rest of the missionary library, before even leaving the MTC. I decided to get serious and take my gospel study to a higher, more academic level, starting with church history. Every time I went to the temple, my favorite line was about the further light and knowledge that God promised to send me. I longed for that. While searching for sources, before I had even read one new book, I had learned enough that my testimony was gone. Once I overcame the shock, it didn't feel like losing something as much as it did going on to a new planet.
All those days watching from the windows, all those years outside looking in, all that time never even knowing just how blind I've been. Now I'm here, blinking in the starlight. Now I'm here, suddenly I see. Standing here, it's all so clear. I'm where I'm meant to be.
Nonetheless, looking back, a few things are clear. The church never wanted me to leave the tower. It had always intended to keep me there, locked up, repainting the same walls and rereading the same books, just like Rapunzel. Richard Dutcher's line about the 99 sheep is correct. Instead of seeking after the one, the church takes out a high-powered rifle and blows your brains out. In some ways, this exploitation is even more manipulative than Mother Gothel's, because for many of us, our spouses, families, friends, community members are the very people trying to keep us in the tower. I love these people, and I don't blame them for what they do. But at the same time, it is very difficult to not see them as agents of my betrayer. A falsehood which robbed me and gave me back a hollow promise of truth. As Rapunzel said, "You were wrong about the world, and you were wrong about me, and I will never let you use my hair again." I haven't had a fairy tale ending, but life is good now. It feels empowering to take back control, to have a sense of meaning and purpose that I create, rather than working on the same scripted eternal plan as someone else. I love my Mormon family and friends so much, and I even love a lot of things about Mormonism. It's tough being myself while trying to maintain these meaningful relationships, but I am trying. I hope someday they can accept and love me for who I am, and maybe even take a trip outside the tower with me.
And it's like the fog has lifted, and at last I see.
everything looks different.
Next up, we have an entry by Seth about polygamy. This one may be surprising to some because in the essay, Seth explains why it is that he supports the legalization of polygamist marriages and how this kind of thinking led him to an unexpected but rewarding new friendship.
I am pro-polygamy. Reactions vary when this comes up in conversation, but overall, I think I'm in the minority. Regarding my beliefs about polygamy, a friend once told me, "You only think that way because you're a man." But that's not why. The reason is because I support the rights of consenting adults to form and maintain their own relationships however they choose to define them. I didn't always think like this. While growing up in the mainstream Mormon church, polygamy was just a quaint 19th century institution practiced by a few people under very specific circumstances. I learned later that this was simply not true, but learning about the alternative lifestyle proclivities of early church leaders didn't upset me. Being from Utah, my family line had multiple polygamists, but when we talked about polygamy, we talked about it in the abstract, an idea that works in theory, like communism or a Chevy. My fascination and passion for studying Mormon history began after I resigned my membership. I resigned in November 2008 after a certain proposition passed. During this month, I was thinking about our fundamental Mormon cousins, and the thought crossed my mind, do the fundamental Mormons use the same version of the Book of Mormon as I do? How do they practice polygamy when the Book of Mormon condemns it? I wondered if this particular verse had been deleted from their copies. Jacob 2:27. Wherefore, my brethren, hear me, and hearken to the word of the Lord, for there shall not any man among you have save it be one wife, and concubines he shall have none. Had I kept reading to verse 30, I probably could have figured out the answer, but thanks to seminary and correlation, only verse 27 was highlighted in my book. I hit Google looking for an answer, and I befriended a woman who's part of an organization in Utah that works to educate the population about polygamy. She does not identify as a Mormon, but she reads the Book of Mormon and believes Joseph Smith was a prophet. She and I spoke often on the phone. About a year later, my partner and I were in Salt Lake in early December, and I called her. I wanted to meet. She agreed, and we made plans to go to dinner. I knew her only by voice, and when I saw her, she looked like any Relief Society president or grandmother who works in the temple and reads biographies from Deseret Book. She looked nothing like a polygamist. I sat down next to my partner, she across the table from us, and we chatted about my trip to Salt Lake and my interest in Mormon history. A comfortable silence entered the conversation, and then she said, "You two aren't just friends, you're a couple." To which I said, "Yes." Then the reality of the situation set in, a young gay couple sitting across the table from a fundamentalist Mormon woman in the bosom of Zion on a snowy winter's evening. But absent any discomfort, pious judgments, and expressions of pity that I commonly face in my relationships with mainstream Mormons when they confront the gay issue. She smiled and said, "We have a lot in common. We both know what it's like to have to fight for our rights." We talked about the umbrella term of fundamental Mormonism and the varying sects. We talked about fundamental Mormonism, fundamental with a capital F, the Warren Jeffs kind with the pastel-colored prairie dresses and gravity-defying bangs. And we talked about fundamental Mormonism, fundamental with a lowercase f, and acceptance of the doctrines as taught by Joseph Smith, including polygamy. She said, "There are some women who have bad experiences with polygamy, and those are their experiences. We don't dismiss that. But those are not the experiences of all people. Most people are very happy in polygamy. I was for over 30 years. I wanted to know how she justified polygamy, even though the scripture in Jacob expressly forbids it. The Lord was speaking to a specific generation in the Book of Mormon, she said, but the Lord revealed the principle of plural marriage in our time to Joseph Smith and promised it would never be taken away. And it never was. Even after the manifesto, Wilford Woodruff and the other apostles took plural wives. The manifesto was issued so that Utah could get statehood, and over time the church phased out an eternal principle to appease the law of the land in opposition to the law of God. Since the 1930s, polygamy in Utah has been a felony, punishable with time in prison. To be suspected of being a polygamist, one can lose housing or a job. True, the authorities don't often go after polygamists, but the law is still on the books and a threat to those who choose to live according to the dictates of their own conscience. It wasn't many years ago that one suspected of being gay faced similar legal persecution. We discussed church history and the way things were before the revelations, manifestos, and correlation gutted the theology and phased out what she and other fundamentalists believed to be eternal principles that once defined a true Latter-day Saint. I asked her what she thought about homosexuality. "Well, theologically, we are opposed to it," she said, "but we would never use the government to impose our beliefs onto others." She paused and added, gay should have the legal right to be married. I didn't expect to hear such a commitment to equality from a woman of her background. We left the restaurant in South Salt Lake. The single streetlight cast a pale yellow light across the parking lot, and I watched her, her sweater speckled in snow, as she took cautious, intentional steps across the icy pavement. We said our thank yous and goodbyes. I watched the red taillights of her car drive off into the darkness, and I left dinner pleasantly surprised that I found an ally in a place I never thought I would.
The following essay is by Roger, and it's about the word of wisdom. He dissects the revelation as found in the DNC and discusses how it can be explained by the culture and context in which it was originally given. He also points out food-based problems and concerns not addressed in the Word of Wisdom, which probably should have been.
I think that is a very fair question to ask. Just what should a person expect out of a document that is purportedly inspired by God? When examining such a document, there are conditions which I would expect to be met if they were genuinely derived from an omnipotent, omniscient, omni-loving deity. The first is accuracy. The second is elegance. I feel that DNC 89 is a prime example of what is clearly not divinely inspired text. Before I go further, I would like to reiterate the LDS understanding that when praying on a spiritual matter, if one is pondering things that are not true, he should be struck with a stupor of thought. Thus, any revelation we have in the canonized works should have been stupor-free. The immediate defense of the so-called Word of Wisdom is the prohibition of alcohol and tobacco. The benefits of avoiding these substances hardly constitutes divine wisdom, even if their prohibition was ahead of its time. Imagine one is trying to create a theocratic utopia, and one can hardly argue that Joseph Smith wasn't trying to do such a thing. Then it is very plain to see that you would not want many drunks around, and therefore a prohibition of alcohol is in order. As far as tobacco is concerned, the Word of Wisdom doesn't directly warn of any health dangers of tobacco. It just says don't apply it to the human body. The hygienic problems caused by tobacco are plainly obvious to any casual observer, so I think it's reasonable to assume that the reason for tobacco prohibition is directly tied to the complaints about tobacco stains on the floor and has very little to do with health. As far as I can see, the best advice coming out of the Word of Wisdom derives its origins not from God, but from a henpecking wife who had a few good ideas. Perhaps the topic which is covered in greatest detail in the Word of Wisdom is something entirely ignored these days, meat prohibition. My first complaint is that of inaccuracy. The Word of Wisdom does not actually convey wisdom. The vegetable dietary equivalent of meat are beans, lentils, peanuts, and some nuts. However, the Word of Wisdom does not actually teach substitution of one protein for another. It says that instead of meat, you should eat grains and herbs. Grains are the edible seeds of plants, and an apologist might try to claim that this includes protein-rich legumes. But I would say that's a logical leap that would not be made without a knowledge of the chemical structure of the plants in question, something that people in the 1930s wouldn't have. And thus grains would necessarily default to cereal grains, such as wheat, barley, and rye. Likewise, with herbs, the term refers to the edible leaves of plants. One might claim that certain legumes are green and thus protein-rich, such as snow peas. But the majority of people would assume this refers to cabbage, broccoli, spinach, lettuce, etc., and only spinach is particularly protein-rich. So that's my accuracy complaint, but I think the elegance complaint is even worse. For a good 70 years after the initial revelation of the Word of Wisdom, meat prohibition was strongly advised, although not entirely mandatory. The reason for this was the belief that animals had souls, albeit inferior to those of humans, and out of respect for those souls, they should be killed and eaten only out of necessity. I find this to be a reasonable theological outlook, which appears to be consistent with the tone or the original text of the Word of Wisdom, and it shows parity with many Eastern religions. However, that ideology was entirely scrapped shortly after the turn of the 20th century. The explanation for this was that modern refrigeration technology made meat safe to eat in any season and rendered that obsolete. I can't do much but facepalm at this. you just can't transition from respecting the souls of animals to eating them as a-okay as long as they've been chilled, especially when there's no mention of either meat preservation or spoilage in the original text. The only way I can make sense of this is that the edict itself was unpopular, and thus the shift in medical understanding from Hippocratic humorism to germ theory gave a convenient basis to get rid of that unpopular edict. And speaking of humorism, the more I think about it, the more I'm convinced that it's the basis of the Word of Wisdom. For those of you who don't know, humorism is the belief that the body is made up of four fluids, which are hot and cool, and wet and dry. One is healthy if these fluids are in balance with each other. The most infamous implementation of humorism was the practice of putting leeches on sick people for bloodletting, which was an activity still occurring in U.S. hospitals during the Civil War. So keep this in mind when you read the passage. And again, hot drinks are not for the belly or body. This is specifically a prohibition on coffee and tea, and more generally a prohibition on caffeine. But if that were the actual intention, the concept could have been expressed even without intimate knowledge of chemistry. I think that it is far more probable that the hot drinks referred to in this passage was actually intended to refer to the thermal and liquid content of the dietary intake, rather than the chemical makeup of the substances. After all, there's no reference to thermally brewed drinks left to cool. This is exacerbated when you look at the early church's view on soup. Apostle George Q. Cannon in the Journal of Discourses say, "We must feed our children properly. We must not permit them to drink liquor or hot drinks, or hot soups, or use tobacco or other articles which are injurious." There is absolutely no reason to prohibit soup, which is a great thing for children to be eating, without the belief in a false medical theory of humorism. My final gripe about the Word of Wisdom is verse 18. It seems arbitrarily to assign different cereal grains to different animals for no apparent purpose. Why would an all-knowing God spend time giving non-advice like this when more clarification earlier would have been much more useful? It was my understanding that a multigrain diet was superior to monograin diet for just about any mammal. And apparently, while wine is taboo, as stated earlier, malt liquor is okay. I'm not just using my own interpretation here. The consumption of beer was not considered a breach of the Word of Wisdom until about the same time that meat was given the all okay for. Imagine a guy goes in for a temple recommended interview and confesses that in the past week he was at a barbecue and washed down his hamburger with a cold beer. The bishop shakes his head, saying, "Brother so-and-so, you realize that it's summer, and we're not experiencing any kind of famine or drought this year, so there's no good reason for you to be eating meat now. I think you need to do some repenting before you next visit the temple." If one were to actually believe the Word of Wisdom as it is written, that's the direction that the conversation should go. However, in reality, while the conversation might be similar, it would be for the exact opposite reason. How can a God who is unchanging flip-flop to a polar opposite position on the same issue in just 70 years? I suspect that some apologists will chime in now, saying that drinking beer is a good way to hydrate yourself when your water source is contaminated. This is true. However, if that were the intent of the scripture, then there would be no reason for the taboo on wine, because wine serves that function just as well as beer. Furthermore, there would also be necessary to specify that the drinks should be watered down enough so that they no longer muddle the minds of men, because beer at its normal strength will still dehydrate you. So by now, I hope I've given a convincing argument that inspiration, at very least, does not protect the president of the church from worthless information. How then can a layman, who is going to be less in tune with the Spirit than the prophet, hope to acquire wisdom through inspiration?
Next, we have an essay by Gardner, who on his 30th birthday reflected back on his 20s, and especially his time spent as a missionary in Italy. And he takes note of how much his perspective had changed in the last 10 years.
Thoughts on my 30th birthday of leaving my 20s. 10 years ago, I spent most of the day trying to get Italians to listen to me talk about the LDS Church. While attracting my companion, told an old man sitting on a park bench that it was my 20th birthday, and the man congratulated me and shook my hand warmly. That evening at the chapel, we had our usual English class, one of the many service projects that missionaries often do, where I had to stop a female college student from kissing me on the cheeks. She was an LDS and was unfamiliar with missionary rules. In my class, my students, who were mostly older Italians and none which were LDS, gave me a beautiful cake, wrote me a poem, and gave me a few other gifts. Afterwards, we went across the street to eat at the pizzeria. A male LDS member at the pizzeria actually kissed me on the cheeks, ironically enough, right in front of the girl who I told not to kiss me earlier. She was rather upset until someone added a little more clarity on the missionary rules than I had. Since that day, I've had a remarkable journey. I completed my LDS mission, completed 2 degrees, met my wife, had 11 different jobs, had 2 children, bought my first car and first home, and met or become better acquainted with a vast array of people that I will always remember and cherish. I would say that it all went by way too fast, but I think that belittles the appreciation I feel for that time and the incredible spectrum of experiences that 10 years has offered. One of the greatest parts of that journey has been the change within brought about by all those experiences. The view of the world I had on that day 10 years ago was incredibly simple and quite frankly naive. It did not account for the incredible complexities or even profound beauty that life has to offer, and that I had never had experiences with. The greatest difficulty was throughout those years, whenever I thought I had figured it all out, something new would come my way which humbled me with the realization that I had been wrong all along. At the end of this 10-year quest, I've come to see that the world is sadly a much more brutal and frightening place than that 20-year-old boy protected in his innocent shell could have ever imagined. But with that discovery has also come so many wonders and remarkable beauties that fill me to bursting with gratitude. Gratitude for an amazing universe providing an infinite exploration of knowledge. Gratitude for the ability to reason and understand the world around us and even ourselves. Gratitude for the long process which has brought us here, that while it may have brought with it our ability for pain and sorrow, it has also endowed us the ability to see, hear, think, appreciate, and find indescribable joy. Gratitude that the journey of discovery continues, that just as I think I've seen it all, a turn in the path opens a whole new world of possibilities. But perhaps one of the greatest founts of gratitude has come from people, including those wonderful Italians I interacted with for 2 years a decade ago. I've come to see that so many of them who I thought were so lost and unhappy without my teachings understood life so much better than I did. They lived life not for invisible realms, but to find tangible love and happiness in the ever-important part of eternity called now. A lesson that, despite many pleas from those good people, was only incorporated after many years of study, soul-searching, and often pain. But a lesson that has taught me that part of enjoying each moment is letting go of anger and resentment, and appreciating instead the beauty and insight that every human being has to offer, whether Mormon, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, agnostic, or atheist, and to find that whatever differences we may have, we can still cultivate the relationships of love and friendship, which will be the source of our greatest happiness.
Next up, we have an essay by Kate, who talks about how she used to think about romance as very Disney-esque. Getting married forever was a notion that very much appealed to her from that romantic perspective. However, she started struggling with the reconciliation of these ideas with the concept of polygamy. Eventually, as an adult, she felt free to finally research the history and doctrines of the church to find answers to her long-held questions about polygamy and Joseph Smith.
22 years ago, the Disney film The Little Mermaid came out in movie theaters. Anyone who's seen it knows that it's a movie about a mermaid princess who falls in love with a human prince. For me, it's a movie about romance, dedication, and doing all you can to have the romance you want. The same year The Little Mermaid came out was the same year I was born. I was raised watching it, and I adored it. As flawed as the story is, I really think that from a young age I took the main message to heart. You do anything you can for your romance. You do whatever you can to have your prince charming. I was raised in the LDS Church. From a very young age, I felt secure in the LDS organization. There were great messages taught to us every week about love and family and relationships. My family was very active. We attended church every Sunday, had multiple family prayers a day, and we held family home evening every week. Our mother was our rock. She encouraged us to do everything we could to be righteous and worthy members of the church. Although I was an anxious child, I loved primary, and I loved church. People there cared about me. When I was 12 years old, we learned about the Mormon pioneers in church. I remember that in passing, one Sunday the instructor mentioned that Brigham Young had 40 wives. Fresh out of primary, I learned that Brigham Young was a polygamist. I was very confused. Brigham Young had more than one wife? How could that possibly be? I thought all prophets were perfect men. I remember going home and looking him up in the encyclopedia. It confirmed that both he and Joseph Smith were polygamists. Being a young, indoctrinated Mormon girl, I dismissed the encyclopedia as being false. The prophets told us that the devil was actively seeking to destroy the church. I assumed that encyclopedia was evidence of this. Maybe Brigham Young was a polygamist, but Joseph Smith certainly wasn't. Years passed, and I remained confused and honestly somewhat hurt. I knew I loved and believed in the church. I also knew that I loved the idea of a monogamous marriage. At that point, I didn't feel threatened, but the idea of the church being the one true church was in a small way falling apart in my mind. Then when I was 14, I became a Mai Maid. This is when in the church they really started pushing temple covenants and temple marriage. It felt like every other week they were talking about being sealed forever, and I ate it up. It was very Disney and very Jane Austen. Nothing seemed more romantic to me than getting married for forever. One day in class, we were discussing temple marriage. The instructor was having my classmates read aloud from DNC 132. Whenever people read aloud, I would just generally space out, so I started reading the chapter silently to myself. I was shocked at the wording. It spoke of polygamy and of people being destroyed. I was completely floored that this was in the scriptures, though at the time I'd never read the Old Testament, and I don't think I would have been surprised if that were the case. In the fourth verse it says outright, "If ye abide not by this covenant," referring to polygamy, "then ye are damned. For no one can reject this covenant and be permitted to enter into my glory." When I got home, I started reading. I reread the whole chapter of DNC 132, and then continued to read the Doctrine and Covenants and the Book of Mormon every night for weeks. I started to have a complete faith crisis. Why would God say these things? Why would a chapter about temple marriage be so harsh? Why was the Doctrine and Covenants saying polygamy was necessary for salvation? At this point, I felt very afraid. I thought my future was shot. I was never going to be able to keep my future husband. At some point, he was going to marry another woman, and if he chose not to marry another woman, he'd be damned. I became very depressed. I prayed every day and continued to read the scriptures, but nothing would relieve me of this fear. I decided I needed to see an authority that I trusted. I made an appointment with the patriarch who had given me my blessing. He asked me if I had any questions about my blessing, but I told him no, and asked him straight away if everybody was going to have to participate in polygamy in the afterlife. He thought about it for a moment and then said, "I do not believe God would ask you to do anything you truly felt uncomfortable with." As nice as a sentiment it was, I was not reassured. Even if God would not ask me personally to participate, polygamy was still doctrine. Any man I married would surely choose God over me, unless he was an unrighteous man. I was crushed. I was left untrusting of men and resentful of the church in general. I thanked the patriarch and left, not feeling much better than I had felt going in. Since I couldn't feel trusting of LDS men, I naturally started to date non-members. It was nice, too, that I didn't feel the pressure to be perfect with non-member boys, and I didn't feel like they'd leave me for another woman or that they'd love God more than me. But I had a problem that I felt immensely guilty for straying away from the church. I didn't want to disappoint my parents, particularly my mother. I had watched my older brothers leave the church, and I could see that she was very upset about it. I didn't feel like I could do that to her. When I was 20, I met a nice non-member man who I trusted, who disliked the idea of polygamy as much as I did. I told him about all the things I loved about the church, and he was then baptized. Although I struggled constantly with the doctrine of polygamy, I still at my core felt that the church was good, and good for me. I felt like introducing others was the right thing to do. Then 2 years later, seemingly from out of the blue, my mother left the church. Everyone in the family was really surprised. I actually remember feeling resentful and angry. All the time she had pushed me and pressured me to participate in church, believe in church, it was all for nothing. I was shocked at myself for getting angry. I felt like I had done all those things at church because I wanted to, but I realized I had done them because I felt afraid not to. It eroded at my testimony even more. Although it was painful and scary for a time, my mom leaving the church eventually led me to feeling free. I suddenly felt like it was okay to research into the church like I had always wanted to find out the truth about polygamy and what the actual doctrine was. I was excited to uncover the truth and be free from the fear I had felt for years. I wanted to strengthen my testimony and become a good, righteous member like my friends at church were. I went online to a website my mother had frequented before she left the church. It was for feminist Mormon women who liked to discuss doctrine and how it affected women in the church. From this website, I stumbled on a site dedicated to the wives of Joseph Smith. I was thoroughly confused. Was any of this true? It had listed the ages of the women, and one girl was only 14 years old. It also listed men that were spouses of the women Joseph was marrying. In one case, two girls were even sisters. I was horrified. The site also linked to a church genealogy website. Right there, it confirmed all of the same information. I knew from growing up and learning about Joseph Smith that there was no mention of this. I knew that Joseph and Emma denied it ever happened. Yet here it was, in the church records, women Joseph Smith had married, and then on another website, various accounts that he possibly had sexual relations with them. I didn't know what to think. I hadn't intended on finding anything that would harm my testimony. I only wanted to know the truth, and here I was, finding out that the man I was supposed to look up to the most besides Jesus Christ was a lying polygamist. It was a very painful time for me. As with most Mormons who come across this sort of information, I wanted to know more. I researched more the beginning of the church and Joseph Smith's history. Everything I found just made me feel worse. I felt deceived and lied to. My testimony completely eroded. It's been over 6 months and I haven't returned to church since. Although it took time, now I can look back and be grateful for what I went through. I learned a lot about myself and what is most important to me. And I think it's interesting that at 14 I was thoroughly seeking out truth like we were taught Joseph Smith did, and it eventually led me to not believing in the church. Maybe if the church didn't teach about personal revelation and personal truth-seeking, I wouldn't have been led on the journey I did. But I think that I would have anyway. I think it was inside me all along. I felt that polygamy was wrong for me, and I wanted my own Prince Charming. That was my dream, and I wasn't going to let that go. So thank goodness for at least the Little Mermaid for teaching me that lesson. I guess I'll just have to have Disney be my religion from now on.
Next, we're serenaded by Travis. He's very partial to LDS hymns and music, but he's also delved into the real and sometimes odd history of our hymns. In this essay, he focuses on In Our Lovely Deseret. And he points out that just as many of our beloved tunes are shared by outsiders, so too are many of the values we hold dear, such as kindness and compassion.
An outsider in Our Lovely Deseret. In our lovely Deseret, where the saints of God have met, there's a multitude of children all around, I bet. The hymn In Our Lovely Deseret is full of energy and enthusiasm. It's dependable for bringing a smile to a face, or at least somewhat reviving a dead congregation. But I'm also partial to hymns in the LDS hymnal that cannot be found in my grandmother's hymnal. Well, the grandmother who wore tank tops and drank coffee, a lifelong Methodist. But because my father converted and married into my mother's pioneer history, the family line I pay attention to, I can look back with ancestral pride as this melody conjures up images of the early Utah Territory. Bonnets, plows, handcarts, Brigham Young waving cheerfully to the children playing in the streets. A multitude of them, apparently. Red, brown, yellow, black, and white, they are precious in his sight. Jesus loves the little children of... Wait a minute. That's not part of In Our Lovely Deseret, and hardly another Mormon song either. That's a song my grandmother would listen to in her church while she held her contemporary Bible stripped of these and those. And can people of color still be classified as yellow, brown, or red? So how does Eliza R. Snow's version go after she'd changed the words from Jesus Loves the Little Children? Hark, 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 'tis children's music, children's voices, oh how sweet. As it turns out, this Mormon hymn didn't originate from Jesus Loves the Little Children. A casual search online shows this melody began as a popular Civil War song about a soldier in prison praising his comrades in gray. with General Lee. And beneath the stars and bars we shall breathe the air again of freemen in our own beloved home. Wow, so much for my romanticized bonnets and brighams. This cheery tune is a stained leftover from the Confederacy. The Confederacy, USA's slaveholding shadow now dead on the waste bin of history. A lot of good that song did for the Confederacy. Deseret didn't fare much better either, I suppose. Slaveholding aside, not only did Deseret's name join the waste bin of history, but also its ideals of theocracy, polygamy, and a communal economy. The word of wisdom endured, however, parts of it at least, and with greater force. That our children may live long and be beautiful and strong, tea and coffee and tobacco they despise. Drink no liquor and they eat but a very little meat. They are seeking to be great and good and wise. It's strange to hear such detailed prohibitions in such a merry melody. It would be like turning the original pamphlet for the Strength of Youth into a jolly musical album. Oh wait, Janis Kett Perry already did. She really did. Such prohibitions in the hymn, however, separate the saints of God from the rest of the world. Karen Armstrong, a British religious writer, emphasizes the Jewish tradition of orthopraxy, that religion is about behaving differently, that it was the Christians who came later and made such a fuss about orthodoxy or believing certain things. Yet Armstrong writes that compassion, translated into practice or concrete acts of loving kindness, has been the litmus test for good theology among all the great faith traditions. Quote, the safest and surest means of attaining enlightenment. They should be instructed young how to watch and guard the tongue, and their tempers trained and evil passions bind. They should always be polite and treat everybody right, and in every place be affable and kind. Politeness, kindness, compassion. These are universal virtues and don't necessarily distinguish the saints in Deseret from the rest of the world. Shoot, my grandmother, the one who would go boating on the lake on Sunday, she was one of the most polite, kind, and compassionate people I knew. But Mormons are different from other faiths in both belief and practice. Snow doesn't explore this difference beyond the word of wisdom in this particular hymn. I think she could have. Heck, she is the one person who has been able to get entire congregations to this day to pray in unison to Heavenly Mother. Have you ever paid attention to the fourth verse of O My Father? It's bold and different. It separates Mormons from the mass of Christian traditions throughout the world. The writers of the musical The Book of Mormon achieved a similar effect when Elder Price sings that Mormons just believe in such high-minded notions as standing tall against your enemy, along with oddball notions as the Garden of Eden being in Jackson County, Missouri, or God changing his mind about black people in 1978. Maybe red, yellow, and brown people are mentioned elsewhere in the show. I haven't had a chance to see it yet. Years before this musical was released, I was a missionary myself, despite all the singing I did while riding my bike or concluding a visit with members. Yes, I was one of those elders. I'm not sure my mission experience would make a good Broadway musical. As John Larson on the Mormon Expression podcast can also attest about missionary service in the States, nothing happens. There is nothing to do. Psychologically, it was taxing to survive hour after hour, day after day, empty column after empty column on that blasted blue planner. But I was faithful and determined, though I can look back now and chuckle over the little tricks I might have done to make the time go by faster. Bike all the way over here to drop by this person. Bike all the way over there to drop by that person. Darn, they must both be at work during the day. Oh, almost lunchtime. Bike all the way back to the apartment. One day, I was tracting with my companion in an upper-class suburban neighborhood in North Texas, and my companion and I started singing In Our Lovely Deseret. Tracting in such neighborhoods were typically a downer, not because people were slamming the door in our faces, but because people in such neighborhoods typically go elsewhere during the day in order to pay for the structures we as missionaries were beating our fists upon hour after hour. Anyway, as it often does, the hymn cultivated a jovial mood between us. As my companion and I were singing the verse about the word of wisdom, I wondered what it would have been like if Eliza R. Snow had progressed to even meatier doctrines verse by verse in the song. As a child of the correlated church, I didn't know, or care to know, many meaty doctrines at the time, but I took a stab at it between each knock on each hollow building. And then one day when I die, and my soul takes off to fly to the spirit world where I will wait my turn to become a god one day with a planet all survey so my goddesses can send our kids to learn. Similar to the humor of Elder Price singing about God and Kolob, my companion and I delighted in the contrast between a snappy tune and a deep, or what we thought were deep, doctrines. At that time in my life, I was deadly serious about strengthening my testimony and obeying mission rules. So my present, inactive self is baffled as to why I found such humor in the silliness of some of my community's unique religious ideas, a community I took very seriously. I suppose I enjoyed it because, first of all, it was created in a safe space. My companion and I were not grappling with serious doubts at the time, so we were able to temporarily laugh at religious ideas we knew the rest of the world would find shocking or ridiculous. Perhaps we knew that stripped of context, as when summarized in a bouncy song, of course such peculiar ideas might be humorous. Yet we could laugh because we knew the whole story. We understood the missing context. We were in the know, and were in some ways laughing at the response outsiders might have to such a verse, rather than the verse itself. Elder Oaks once said that what unites us is far more important than what differentiates us. But differences matter, right? Especially when such differences act as an adhesive binding a religious community together. Perhaps what unites Mormons is what differentiates Mormons. The different hymns, the different scriptures, the different doctrines, the different perspectives, the different prohibitions. Then you find out that 19th century Utah probably wasn't like the Deseret you imagined in your head. That music to a favorite hymn can have a troubling genealogy. And that the same music you once claimed as your own is shared by all kinds of religious groups who also share important ideas about kindness, politeness, and compassion. That an outsider need not remain outside because there is much that unites us. I perceived my grandmother, the one who sipped iced tea on hot afternoons, as an outsider in my life. I defined her by what she didn't believe or how she didn't behave. I let differences matter. My grandmother, the one who loved her family and worshipped God, she died a number of years ago, and at this point I'm not sure if she's in a spirit world waiting for her work to be done to become a god one day. I might even laugh at that notion, and for different reasons than when I was a missionary. But wherever she is, perhaps I will end up in that location too, since I am more prone at this time in my life to drink coffee and go boating on a Sunday. And maybe, even in that location, like the angels up above, those outside and inside our lovely Deseret can with happy hearts and cheerful faces meet.
So is it easier to believe or to think? Is it easier to just follow along than it is to forge a separate path for yourself? David says yes, but he also says, start thinking and reasoning, Mikey. He puts out the challenge to escape from religious manipulation by accepting the difficult but worthwhile task of increasing your critical thinking and reasoning skills.
Mikey, come on in. I wasn't sure if I was going to see you again after our brief conversation the other day. I just noticed. Hey, you're left-handed. Why did you choose that? You say you didn't? It's just the way God made you? Interesting. What's that? Oh, you just wanted to see if you understood what I was getting at the other day. Good. Hey, I hope you don't mind if I call you Mikey. Yeah, I know it's a holdover from that old commercial for Life cereal. Give it to Mikey. He'll eat anything. Only when I said it to you, I changed it a little. Tell it to Mikey. He'll believe anything. And we are talking about life, and it's not the cereal. I guess I was trying to get you to think, just a wee tiny bit. It is easier to believe than to think. Let me say it again, just to make sure you got it. It is easier to believe than it is to think. In my first year at Ricks College, I ran across a book entitled Escape from Freedom by Eric Fromm. Written after the Second World War, Fromm examines why an entire nation basically handed over their thinking to the Nazis. It really made life a whole lot easier. All you had to do was obey. The Nazi Party put a lot of emphasis on obedience, meaning that it was drilled into the people constantly not to think, only obey. All the thinking was already done. The Führer knows best. The party is always right. Just do what you are told. They were serious about it, too. If you were caught listening to foreign broadcast on the radio, you would be sent to a concentration camp for re-education. Consider yourself lucky if you survived. Children would even turn in their parents. Terrible as it sounds, it really happened. Something clicked, and I have always remembered it. Escape from freedom. Now back to the difficult task of thinking. You can only do your thinking for yourself. And this is harder than it appears on the surface. Most people are subject to religious manipulation in their life or family. Usually starts when you are very young. It is difficult to face long hidden or suppressed doubts about religion. It is even harder to engage in the ultimate declaration of liberation from organized religion. You are then faced with the double-edged sword of living without the crutch of a supernatural friend and learning to accept full responsibility for life. It is just easier to believe or pretend to believe and go without or go with the flow. This stuff is really, really hard. You face both terror and relief. The terror at realizing there is no longer an imaginary friend. Relief that no one is looking over your shoulder anymore. You need to ask the questions that will lead you to critically examine the influence of religion in your life and culture. Most are blind to the irrationalities of their own religion, yet see clearly the problems of other religions. You can see the speck of dust in the other's eye, yet miss the two before sticking out of your own. And most Mormons are better at confessing the other person's sins than their own. As a member of Western culture, realize that you have been indoctrinated. No matter what your upbringing, you live in a religious sea, and you cannot help but swallow some of the water. Religious dogma, habit, beliefs, or guilt may affect you in ways you may not recognize. Take a piece of paper and calculate how many hours of your life, the only life you have, and start to add up all the hours spent in church or church-related functions. What amounts and kind of training have you received in critical thinking? If you are like most people, my guess is close to zero. I mean, who wants to be an intellect and be a threat to the church? Which reminds me of something my son said. Church is just a boring timeshare presentation for Jesus. And so it is hard to have a rational conversation about the irrational aspects of one's beliefs. Really makes it hard to apply reason and critical thinking. A couple of weeks ago, a doomsday cult predicted that the earth would end. It would happen at the same time in each time zone. Because, you know, God respects the international dateline. Well, one devotee who was interviewed on CNN said with such firmness and conviction, "I know this is going to happen." First, I thought I was in a spooky Mormon hell dream, reliving an old travel moaning meeting. I wasn't. Surprise! We're all still here. So much for knowing the earth is going to be destroyed. Which reminds me of another Stiermanure saying, love the sinner but hate the sin. Let's see, so I hate rape, but I love rapists. Or how about murder? Oh, I hate murder, but I love murderers. Why do we then try and kill them? That's not very loving. You have one life, and guess who is responsible for it? You. Learn to think and reason. Understand the fallacies of poor thinking and reasoning. work on making critical thinking an everyday habit. You'll spend less at the mall and won't fall for as-seen-on-TV crap. Considerable amount of dialogue you hear is really the dialogue of the deaf. No one is really listening. They are just screaming from their particular point of view. If you want to have some real fun, tape one of Rush's rants and then go back with a fine-tooth comb and find all the mistakes and logic and erroneous claims and mistakes he makes. Then apply those skills to religious beliefs. Take responsibility for your life and what you believe. Think. Think hard. Really hard. Question. Ask. Reason. Incredible claims require incredible evidence. Don't get suckered in. So here's my question for you. Why is it that it seems that whenever a question about some aspect of Mormonism comes up, it seems like there is a long explanation and justification, often conflicting with what other prophets or inspired people have said? Tell me why. When Richard Packham came home and shared this with his wife, "Honey, the church is not true," he had realized that all of the problems and convoluted explanations just go away when you understand that the church is not true. So here it is, Mikey. You have to figure it out for yourself, because the only one that can change your life is you. Anything else would be unrighteous dominion. The true purpose of life, as I see it, is to experience and participate in loving relationships, to have a deep personal connection on all levels, emotional, physical, thinking, and spiritual. And yes, you can do that without God or a Jewish zombie being ever fearful of a cosmic boogeyman to scare you into doing others' bidding. Love you all. Out.
Both be speaking to and all.